In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
When most of us think of Victoria, British Columbia, we picture beauty. The spectacular harbor, the charming historic buildings, and especially at this time of year, the gorgeous gardens all across the city. But it wasn't all that long ago that downtown Victoria, the place now bustling with high-end shops and trendy bars, was home to a stroll, a place where young girls were openly sex trafficked. And between the summers of 1990 and 1991, three of those girls were murdered, their cases unsolved to this day, and there are some with knowledge of those cases who believe that a serial killer has been walking free for more than three decades.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that that's still under investigation. Somebody's got that file on their desk, and they're still looking at it.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Laura Palmer is the host of Island Crime. Season 6 of Island Crime, titled Sweethearts, focuses on the mystery of what happened to those girls and explores the context around their deaths. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Jordan.
This season is, a lot of your seasons are troubling. This season is also troubling. Why don't you begin by telling us where you heard about these murders that we're going to discuss today?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, I was researching the abduction of 4-year-old Michael Dunahy in Victoria. And one of the people I talked to was a guy named Don Bland, who's a retired Victoria police officer. And he was one of the leads on the Michael Dunahy case, a detective with the Victoria Police back in the early 90s. And when I was talking to Don, I asked him, just to give me a little bit of context, tell me what's happening in Victoria at the time, because I'm just trying to wrap my head around what the police force was dealing with back then.
Right.
And he said, we were actually really busy back then because there had been three murders of young women and they are still unsolved. I remember thinking at the time, I had never heard that before. And I have been working out here on the coast since the early 90s, but that was just something I'd never heard about before at all. So I kind of filed it away and thought, at some point, I'm going to go back and try and learn more about that. And then just about a year or so ago, I had an email from a woman named Rhonda Waterfall. And Rhonda was a high school friend of Kimberly Gallup's. Kimberly is one of the girls who was murdered back then. And Rhonda basically said to me, she felt that her friend's murder back then was never really taken as seriously and that it didn't get its due in the public. So Rhonda felt that something could be done now to address these feelings she had that really Kimberly's case was forgotten and that maybe now there might be a way to try and push the investigation forward if someone looked into it. That, combined with hearing from Don Bland, made me feel like there was certainly something that I could look into.
So you decided on this case for season 6 of the show. You started digging in, you started researching. As you began to do that, what really stood out to you? What felt compelling about this case?
So a number of things. But I'd say the first thing that stood out for me is that these were three ordinary girls. And that's something I heard repeatedly from their friends and family. And I suppose when you think about it, yeah, of course they were three ordinary girls. But that's not how the story was told 30 years ago.
Right.
The story that was told in the media then was, you know, teen hooker number one, teen hooker number two, teen hooker number three.
Give us a sense, actually, if you can, of some of the headlines that were written about them, because you and I have discussed this, and this was commonplace back then. I didn't even think about it until you read them today, and you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not going to be self-righteous about this, because I was a journalist back then as well.
Yeah.
And that's how we talked about people in the sex trade. And it didn't matter if they were 16 years old or 30 years old. They were hookers. And maybe you might say prostitute also, you know, isn't the kindest word, but those were the words that we used to describe people in the sex trade. I was working at the CBC. It was no different. And so I'm not in any way sort of pointing fingers at any one particular paper or journalist, because that was the pack back then. That's how we behaved journalistically. But I can tell you that every single family member I talked to raised this as a real harm on them. And that, you know, back then, picking up the paper and seeing that headline when you've lost your 16-year-old daughter is pretty hard, you know? Of course, the murders of their daughters is what preoccupies them now and wanting justice. But I would say, almost equally, the shame and the stigma that went around with it still matters to them now. And so I really felt that that was something I could address in this series and really put a focus on who these girls were in life and the fact that this could have been anyone. And when you hear their stories, you will think about the teenagers in your life or yourself as a teenager and think how easily this could happen to you as well. Because these girls were lured, Romeoed into situations where they went from being someone's, you know, girlfriend to being trafficked on the street, sometimes within weeks, you know? And it's that I think really got me hooked on this story at the outset.
Before we get into what happened to them and the investigation afterwards, as you mentioned, they're normal girls if you know them. Tell us quickly about them. Who are the sweethearts?
Yeah. So episode one focuses on Kimberly Gallup. You know, when I looked at her high school picture, I just instantly connected with her because I was a teenager around the same time. We had the same hairstyle, the big hoop earrings, the kind of glossy lipstick. She is just a normal kind of teenager, late 80s, early 90s. And she is a big fan of Bon Jovi. She loves the Kansas City Chiefs. She's into race cars and is for a little while a trophy model out at the racetrack here. But she's just, you know, a normal teenage girl. Her friends actually describe her as being quite soft, maybe a little bit shy. You know, most of them had no idea that she was leading this other life, being sex trafficked in the downtown streets of Victoria. The second girl whose story I tell is a girl named Sherry Lynn Smith. And Sherry Lynn Smith is actually from Regina. And she goes to a Catholic high school. She's doing really well in school. She's very bright. She plays the flute and she plays the piano. And she's very involved in her church. She's in a touring puppet group called the God Squad. And, you know, comes from this very conservative Christian family, I would say. She goes out to what they call Buffalo Days, which is the fair in Regina. And she meets a guy at the fair. You know, she's 16. She falls in love instantly with this guy she meets at the fair. And 2 weeks later, she is on the street being trafficked in Edmonton. Mm. Like it's that fast. And her parents, of course, try everything to get her off the street and bring her home. But she sinks further and further into that life. And she is 6 months pregnant when she's murdered just a year later in Victoria. And the third girl whose case I look at is Melissa Nicholson. And Melissa, I'll just tell you this briefly. One of the local TV stations here did a story about the podcast. And as part of that, they unearthed some archival footage from back when Melissa's murder happened. And they showed a picture of Melissa. Up until then, I'd only ever seen one picture of Melissa ever. And more importantly, her family only have one picture of her. She has surviving brothers and sisters and a stepmom, and they only ever had this one very small, like a little high school picture of her. But because this was unearthed, they now have this gorgeous picture of Melissa where she's posing. It looks like she's on a ferry, and her hair is kind of curly, and it's blowing in the wind. She has this big smile. And, you know, I heard from them last night, and they are so thankful just to have that one picture, you know? But yeah, she was just the same. Unfortunately, she came from a very troubled background, a really kind of dysfunctional family. And she, it looks like, was probably on the street as early as 14, in and out of being sex trafficked at the time of her death. But, you know, she wanted to be a hairdresser. She was really into cars, too. And she just seems like she was a sweet kid who just couldn't get a break.
So what do we know then about how these young women died? And I guess also just how they all ended up in the same area of Victoria when they did.
So back then, young girls were being sex trafficked on a circuit. So they would move around Western Canada to all the big cities. And in this case, they were being trafficked in Victoria here on the island. So at that point in time, there was a stroll. And the stroll was, if you've ever been to Victoria, it was right where all the tourists go. It was right on Government Street, which is like a busy little hub for businesses and tourists. It's not far from the harbor. And that's where they were being trafficked. So from anywhere around 10 o'clock at night till maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, you would see like all these young girls out on the stroll. And that's where all three of these girls were last seen before their murders. Sherry Lynn Smith is the first one of the three who's killed. And she disappears in June of 1990. She goes missing. And it's not until September that her body is found in the bushes just outside of Victoria in an area called Saanich. And then it's Kimberly Gallup who is found dead in a hotel room just a few months later in November of 1990. And Kimberly is discovered by some of her friends, another young woman who is being sex trafficked at the time. You'll hear from her in the series. It's 30 years ago, but she remembers it in great detail, exactly what happened that night. And then finally, Melissa Nicholson is, again, she's in the downtown stroll in Victoria the last night that she's seen alive and is found 3 days later, just outside Victoria, dumped in the bushes in an area called Shaunigan Lake. The unfortunate thing, well, everything about this is unfortunate, but because their bodies are found in different places, they are investigated by three different police authorities.
Right.
Yeah. So Victoria, you know, like a lot of places, has this fractured police jurisdictions that sometimes mean information is not shared as efficiently, perhaps, as it could be. And certainly back then, when computers are just coming on, you know, it's likely, I would say, that not everything was being communicated as well as it could have been.
So these girls, within a few blocks of each other, disappear, turn up murdered. What do we think about the chances that these murders were done by the same person? And I guess more importantly, as you go back looking for it, did the police then have any idea that these cases could be connected?
So what you read in the newspaper accounts at the time is the standard line from police is, we have no reason to believe these cases are connected beyond the fact that these girls are working in a dangerous profession. And that is the line that gets repeated over and over and over again. However, there are also a few stories where advocates, friends are raising the question and wondering if there could be a connection. And the police are talking to each other. There are a number of occasions where you see that, you know, police from these three jurisdictions, as well as others, have gotten together with a goal of trying to see if there is anything to connect these cases. There is one police officer quoted, a guy named Doug Bond, who says at one point that they have evidence to believe the cases are connected to some other cases in Vancouver. That's written about, and then nothing for 30 years is ever said again about that. So the police from these three jurisdictions would not talk to me about these cases. They said, look, they're open and active, and we don't want to, what is it, harm the integrity of the investigation. And so I was trying to talk to retired police officers, doing what I could to, you know, get any information about the investigations. Mm-hmm. And then I stumble across this police union podcast. They're doing an interview with a retired detective named Chris Horsley. They do three episodes with him where he's just talking about his whole career. And it's really interesting and fascinating to me because he just, you know, starts talking about Sherry Lynn Smith's case. And what he reveals in that podcast is that there is a detective who has been working on Sherry Lynn's case now, is working on her case now, who believes that her case is connected to six or seven cases. And so he says in that podcast that he has no doubt that there was a serial killer active in Victoria in the early 1990s. So, I mean, that is not coming from an official police source on any one of these investigations, but it's pretty close. You know, he was the spokesperson for the Saanich police for, I don't know, at least 10 years. So it's pretty close to a confirmed police source, I would say. So, you know, to me, it does seem likely that maybe not all three, but at least two of these cases are probably linked. And I'm hoping that in the months, maybe years to come, we'll learn exactly what happened. And that's because of DNA, which is probably a whole other question, but I do go there in the series and what that might look like.
The series is really thorough, and I can't take listeners through all of it, nor would I want to, because it's just begun. The second episode is out today. So in the absence of police, give us a sense of who else you talked to and what kind of sense you've got of what might have happened.
So I talked to everyone.
I know you do.
Yeah. So family, friends, witnesses, experts, retired police, really anyone who I think can possibly inform the story in ways big and small, you know? In this case, you know, I really knew very little about sex trafficking. And I would say I had a lot of misconceptions about what it looked like then and now in Canada. So that's an area that I did need to learn about in this series. I think I actually, you know, from time to time in when I was doing some of my other investigations, I would have people ask, you know, well, do you think they could have been trafficked? And it, part of me was like, really, is that something we really think is happening here? Isn't that something that happens in other countries? Or I don't know. I think I had this idea that it was just not happening. And I was so wrong, you know, but it's not what I thought it was. Like, I didn't think about the idea of these guys charming young women, pretending to be their boyfriends. And, you know, that kind of manipulation that goes into it. It's not that they're like picked up off the street and thrown into the back of a van and sent off to another country. It's like slow and manipulative and really evil. Like, I did for this series also talk with a former sex trafficker. And so that perspective is there as well.
So tell me a little bit, don't spoil the whole thing, but tell me a little bit about DNA and current investigations and what it might take to actually solve this case.
So in the series, I speak with a retired Calgary police officer who was one of the first to actually get a criminal conviction on a case using genetic genealogy DNA. And she tells me this incredible story about a woman who was raped in her home right around the same time of these murders, so early 1990s. And for 30 years, nothing on this case, just sits there. And then she and her colleagues are starting to hear about the work that's happening down in the States with genetic genealogy. And they don't know anything about it. And they decide they're going to train themselves to do this and do the research and work with a lab down in the States. And they find the person who did this horrible rape 30 years ago and go knocking on his door. And it's really, I mean, they had to train themselves. There weren't the kind of researchers who are now working on many police forces in the States and some in Canada. But it is really a game changer for cold cases. It is the thing that's solving cold cases now. And in fact, one of the guys I talked to, a criminologist, said, if you're a true crime fan and you really care about solving cases, you should go get a DNA test, because at some point we're going to be like one cousin away from solving every cold case out there. It's the thing that is solving the cases. Now, he's advocating this in a way that, frankly, I'm not comfortable with, because I feel like I don't know enough about what the concerns and the privacy risks are and everything else. But I do absolutely see the advantage for police in being able to use this technology. And I would say, when it comes to the rights of, a serial murderer versus the rights of just somebody putting their DNA out there, I guess, I feel like it's worth it to me. And I know I'm probably not saying that or communicating that as well as I should, but I actually went and got a DNA test myself at that point, just because I thought if there is a chance some link out there is going to help solve a case, why wouldn't I do that?
I mean, that's a whole other podcast that we should do someday, because there are incredible ethical concerns around this, but at the same time, incredible potential for, sure, solving cases, but also just finding missing people, et cetera, et cetera. But listen, Laura, thank you so much for this. It's always fascinating to hear what you dig up 30 years later, and I can't wait to listen to the rest of the episodes. Before we go, you have a theme song for this season. We'll play a little bit of it. Tell us what it is.
So the song is called Dance in the Rain, and I was looking for a piece of music that would fit the mood, the tone of the series, and I came across this song. It's actually a couple of years old. It's by a singer-songwriter who goes by the name Bolshe. And anyway, the song is just got a kind of a haunting, eerie feel to it. The music video that goes along with it is anime. And I just thought it spoke to a kind of a teenage, angst that I connected with the story of these girls. And I've already had a number of people connecting with me and asking me about the song. So I think it's hitting home for people, and I hope it means something for the families as well.
Here is a little bit of it, and thanks again, Laura.
Thanks, Jordan.
Another fall, another try, another call. You made your choice to be alone. You had the chance to change it all. Another moon, another sun. You drop your petals one by one. You shut the roses with your gun. You didn't stay, you chose to run. I'm not mad, I'm just sorry. I couldn't make you feel safe. I will give you space, don't you worry. I will learn how to dance in the rain. I'm not mad, I'm just sorry. I couldn't make you feel safe. I will give you space, don't you worry. I will learn how to dance in the rain.
Laura Palmer, host and creator of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is out right now. Episode 2 drops today, wherever you get your podcasts. That was The Big Story. For more from us, which you can also get wherever you get your podcasts, or you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you want to give us some feedback on this episode or any other, the way to do that is via email, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca, or with a phone, call us 416-935-5935. Let us know what you think. The Big Story is available
as mentioned, now for the third time, wherever you get podcasts. But more importantly, it's also on your smart speaker, so you can just ask it to play the Big Story podcast. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.